tonight on Arena. Frank McGuinness on his new poetry collection, May 22nd, and the Turner Prize winning Array Collective bring their work to the Galway Arts Centre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. May 22nd is a new poetry collection from Frank McGuinness, the writer best known for plays, many plays, including Observe the Sons of Ulster and Dolly West's Kitchen. The new collection begins in Clonmany in his native Donegal, ends in Belfield, the UCD campus where he studied and then taught for years. In between, he roams far and wide in time and place, dancing with Goya for 23 poems in the middle of the connection, paying homage to Jane Austen and, of course, Lyra McKee along the way as well. Delighted that Frank McGuinness is with me in studio this evening. Good to have you here, Frank.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Sean.
May the 22nd. You didn't just pluck that date out of the air.
No, it's my mother's birthday. And I should say that being the prize chancellor that she tried to have three birthdays. A, on the grounds was one more than the Queen, and B, they just hoped that she would get three presents. Never worked, actually. May 22nd was the official.
Yeah,
so we stuck to it, and so did she at the end.
So there aren't two other subtitles underneath May 22nd?
Not, she would have had it if she would, God rest her, if she was still alive. But no, that's her birthday.
Did the other two birthdays, did just the month and the day in the month change, or did the year move
the
as well?
The year never moved. She died at the age of 29, and she stayed 29 for about at least 50 years. But that was our favourite number. So she, together with 22, 29 was it. And, you know, if you dared question that, then even now I think she would raise from the grave and haunt you.
Yeah, a touch of the Lady Bracknell's about that, isn't
it? Slightly, an attractive age, 29, very attractive age.
How important, I know one's parents are hugely important in their lives, but how did your relationship with them, how does that feed into writing? You know, what kind of prism does it travel through before it makes it to the page?
Oh, they were an enormous influence, actually. They left school, both of them, when they were 14. My mother went to work in the shirt factory, and my father was driving lorries from about the age of 12 because his father had that business. My father was a great driver, I mean, a wonderful driver. None of his children learned to drive. That's one of the great ironies. But he drove a bread van then for most of his working life. And they were clever people in their way. They were very much steeped in local knowledge and local lore. And, I mean, they had a great way of prizing information out of you, both of them. And I would like to think that in their subtle way, they influenced me on that too.
Oh, you reckon you're good at the prizing of
God? No, I never ask questions.
That's a really good way to get an answer, isn't it? To not ask a question.
Particularly when you answer it for yourself.
The woman with no shadows. Why is she, should we listen to the poem and then talk about why she's a woman with no shadows?
Okay.
Why don't we listen to it? For Kieran and Morris are the dedicatees here
as
well.
These were good pals of mine, actually. Kieran's passed away very quickly and very sadly, and Morris is a great fellow. The woman with no shadows. They were all born in May. The 22nd, if you must know. When asked, that's what they say. The woman with no shadows, they never cross red water. Lough Derg is then a no-no. St. Patrick lacks a daughter. These women search the forest to find a lost child, a prince, maybe a beast, turning the wild things mild. They wait as the moon unwinds through the calm of clouds, believing in ties that bind the pockets in a shroud. The women with no shadows, they wander where they please. They bargain with friend and foe the price of rubies. The women with no shadows fought like devils in Petersburg, frozen city, frigid, haloed in the mists of Lough Derg. Do these women wake at night, devouring the dark? Switch on the electric light. Let sorrows leave their mark. They drench the sky, they kiss the sea, flowers in Maytime grow. They have me as they reared me, the woman with no shadows.
The Women with No Shadows, a poem from the new collection from Frank McGuinness, that new collection being called May the 22nd. So are there several women involved here, or were there several women inside your mother? Is that what we're dealing with?
Well, it's actually a title of an opera by Richard Strauss, an extremely strange opera, The Woman with No Shadow. And that was the basis for the poem. But it's very much a poem about my mother and her and my aunts and their capacity for extraordinary enigmatic statements that you think you would know them well, and then suddenly they would defy you. The Loch Derg reference is very deliberate. They all worked in a shirt factory, and once a year there was a pilgrimage from the shirt factory to Loch Derg in Donegal. But my mother and her sisters all had red hair, and they found out that if a woman with red hair went on the boat to Loch Derg, it sank. This was a well-known belief. Now, I subsequently have tried to find this out, and it seems that only they believed that, but it was enough to get them out of going to Loch Derg.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think it's a well-known belief or a well-known excuse or a little-known excuse?
Sean, it was a well-known belief among those five very honourable and religious women.
Yes, I'll take that at face value. In terms of that shirt factory aspect of it, and that the women that brought you up, I mean, these are the women that brought you up. You've often spoken about how important they were to your
first
early
play
life.
Was the factory girls. Yeah,
yeah, of course, which dealt specifically with that shirt factory, that whole shirt factory idea. Is that a thing of the past now, do you think, this, you know, the village rearing the child?
No, I don't think so, actually. I mean, I have no children, but my cousins, now all their children are having children, and it's still, you know, very much a tradition that generations rear the kids, certainly in Buncrana. That would be certainly the case for everybody belonging to me. You know, we had a massive, big gathering, a big connection, as they say, and we're still very close, all of us. And I think that the children of, you know, of 5 and 6 and 7 now will have the same thing as they grow older. They will be related to an awful lot of people. Inevitably, very, you know, few of us married from my generation for some reason or other. But that doesn't stop, you know, a lot of kids being born, a lot of children being there and being loved. And I think that part of the love is passing on that massive sense of family, that massive sense of duty, if you like. And we've got that. And even the younger ones, you can see it coming through from a very early age. They know who they are.
And family means more, I suppose, now than just, you know, aunts and uncles by blood or whatever way you want to put that. Family's a much broader term.
It is, but I think blood counts for an awful lot, actually. I would never underestimate the blood.
There's a Buncrana statement, if ever
there
I heard.
Indeed, yes.
a lot of this collection, Frank, was written during lockdown.
Yes.
Now, obviously, for a large part of your life, you were working as a lecturer in UCD. So I often marvelled at how you managed to write one play in that period of time. Would have been amazing, never mind the several that you did write. What did lockdown give you, and particularly the fact that you give us quite an extensive collection of poetry here? Did it allow more introspection, or did it force more introspection?
Well, I had retired from UCD when lockdown happened, so that was one good thing. I never would have managed the computer stuff, the Zoom meetings. I think that Danielle Clark, who's head of department, said the only good thing to come out of this is that you're not working here still. I would have driven her demented, I feel, actually. But I found that during lockdown, yes, I did turn more to poetry than anything else. Because I don't think you can underestimate the size of shock, the seismic shock about the theatres closing. I mean, that to me was something that I had never envisaged could have happened in my lifetime or in my experience. And it went beyond, you know, closing the doors. It was almost like the mental doors were closing as well. The mental windows were being shuttered. So many people I knew had no work. Yeah. They really were out of work. And that from the most industrious of industries in theatre, where you're working all the time to scrape a living, mostly on the clippings of 10.
Yeah.
But there was nothing happening. And that really was a terrible burden to bear for everybody. And we shared that together, I think. And I was driven into my own resources as a poet. Now, I had published 6 books beforehand, so at least I wasn't a novice at that stage. I knew kind of how to balance things out between the writing, as I balance things out between the teaching and the writing. And I always need some kind of confrontation within myself to bring out what I hope will be the best. It was the teaching versus the theatre at one time. And in this, it was theatre versus the poetry. But I needed that kind of conflict. I needed that sense of unease to get stuff done. And I was very glad that I had got the poetry to go in and try to examine what it was that made me want to be a poet, made me want to write poetry. And that's what I tried to do in this, the seventh collection. Some people might say it's about time, but I mean, at least I've tried to do it in this one.
Yeah, I get a sense of a much more personal aspect to many of the poems in this. In fact, I would say, do you have that sense?
No. I think I lay all the time, actually, and you never can tell when I'm, you know, up to what I'm up to.
All right, well, let's listen to The Avenue in Lockdown. Okay. And I'm presuming that this is the avenue you live on, but clearly...
This is Buddhist Town,
All right, so you weren't lying about that.
Well, possibly, who knows. Never...
page 73, if you're looking for it. Page 73, The Avenue in Lockdown from Frank McGuinness. And this from the new collection, May 22nd.
I buy strawberries and Gleasons, packs of wine gums, papers, brandy, a bottle of strong Calvados I drink no longer but keep for friends after we'd eat our dinner. None visit now. How could they leave? Be polite. Call this seclusion. Locked in where we spend nights, days, the weeks absconding into months, sending texts and emails to ghosts. We once embraced as our own. Jokes we share about those we worked with. Who should know better, but who does? Does what? Annoy in ways we did. When was then? Before Easter time. The ice stiffens the leg of lamb. Bottles of red lie unopened. The avenue deserts its cars. They refuse all invitations. In gardens, birds meet and mate, singing obeids to their strange young, greedy for all that's going, eating the nest underneath them. A fox nicks my neighbour's sneakers. Its tongue unties the cross laces. Bones are buried where all forget to take the time to tell what's what, the ups, the downs of what infects.
Frank McGuinness with his poem, The Avenue in Lockdown, from his new collection, May 22nd. I know, I think I've probably asked you this before when it comes to the writing of the poems, Frank, to what extent there's a character, because we associate you with the theatre, we associate you with the writing of plays. To what extent there's some kind of character there? I know you shot me down with, no, I always tell lies. But I really do get a sense that you're a bit more opening of yourself here, opening yourself out. Like, that's about your home. That's about the things that were happening outside, or not happening, as the case may be, in that period, outside your window. That's a very personal viewpoint.
It is, but it's still a character. It's still a voice speaking. I need to hear that voice. Mm. I mean, that's the training as a playwright. And it's I never, ever have written about me coldly, per se, me. I just need to have that creation of a voice, that creation of a persona, and that's what I work from. I wouldn't be able to write without that.
And it's interesting then when it comes to wonderful sequence in the middle of the collection. This is the Lyra McKee poem, Visions of Lyra. Mm. Obviously a reference to Lyra McKee, who died in Derry in 2019. You take seven different film directors.
That's right,
And just explain what you're doing with that long sequence of poems.
Well, Lyra McKee, to me, her loss is monumental. I think she had the makings of one of the most important women of her generation. In fact, I think she is one of the most important women of her generation. And to be silenced in such a savage and cruel way, our country can, you know, we've lost a great woman. And I really never came to terms with the scale of that disruption in our culture until I had to write the poems. And I knew I didn't want to write a conventional lament for her, but I wanted to see her in the many angled ways that she wrote and in the many angled ways that she understood the world about her, and the way her astounding compassion registered when it came to understanding the complexity of culture in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. And I felt that possibly the metaphor that would serve best to appreciate the sheer scale of our achievement was that of film, and of big directors who would give me access into interpreting the shock of her death. And each of these seven poems is a type of mourning, a type of shock, as I say, but I wanted it to be a great cry of loss for the best, as I call her in the last poem.
And so we've people, you've got directors like Kurosawa, David Lean, Fellini is in there, Peter Weir.
Agnes Varda, Peter Weir, yeah.
But I wonder too, to what extent is, you know, when you're approaching the kind of the sheer emotional weight of something like that, not is it easier, but is it, I don't know what the word is, by looking through somebody else's eyes, can you actually express something with less overpowering emotion?
Absolutely. This is what I mean about even in a poem, you have to cultivate the voice. You have to create the character. You have to see it through the eyes of the other. And I didn't want to, I didn't want to tread on Lyra's parents or her partner, Susan Canning's grief. And my friend, Susan Mackay, read it before doing anything, and she said it would be okay to go ahead with it. She asked Susan, would it be okay? Or she asked Sarah, rather, it would be okay. And I did do it, you know, as a memorial, but I wanted it to be objective insofar as it can be. And I don't have any right to have a personal grief overruling what I want to say about Lyra McKee. I didn't meet her, I didn't know her, and I only read most of her work after she'd gone, but I knew enough when it happened that something terrible had happened, and I wanted to register my sense of loss, and I think the country's sense of loss as well.
Yeah, and if you like, that's a kind of a Visions of Lyra, and it is a dance with grief, with another big section called Dancing with Goya, which is a mad 23 mad poems of different
well,
Goya.
I love Goya. And there was this exhibition in the Courtauld, which is my favourite gallery in London, of these extraordinary, strange, violent drawings as Goya can, only Goya can be. I had been, since I was a young fella, obsessed with Lorca, and not least with his surreal poetry. His plays I had done versions of and I had directed. But I really wanted to combine these influences, the pictorial influence of Goya and the verbal influence of Lorca, and see what would happen if you got loose in these anarchic, to put it mildly, drawings where everything is in chaos. But at the same time, it's Goya, so they're beautifully drawn. And I love that combination of utter squalor and utter beauty, and only the Spanish can do it. I mean,
well, Goya and Lorca rubbing shoulders is one thing, but you do have a new play coming up, Dinner with Groucho.
Dinner with Groucho.
Who are you putting together in that particular play?
Well, in this one, it's actually based on a real meeting that did happen between Groucho Marx and T.S. Eliot, and they were great fans of each other. They wrote to each other, and there are a couple of letters extant from each of them complimenting each other. So this is very much another piece of anarchy, you know, locked in during the shutdown. I think mines went slightly bananas, and this is my anti-lockdown play. I did one for The Gate, the Visit Now, which is very much about lockdown, and this is the opposite. Because anything can happen. It's Groucho Marx and T.S. Eliot with an extremely strange woman who's the proprietor of the Sawdust restaurant where they meet. And believe me, anything does happen.
Well, I was interested because when you were talking earlier on about the poetry, you know, you mentioned this idea of kind of going back into yourself. And I was wondering to what extent, you know, you could have written a play. And you're saying this actually was written during lockdown?
Oh, no. This came beforehand, actually. But it was refined during lockdown. And we just, my friend Alison McKenna is producing it with Jane Brennan, Bespoke. They came looking for something, and they're the only ones came looking for something. So here it is.
So do you need to have that aspect? Do you need to have a kind of a production behind you or something?
No.
Could you write a play in total isolation?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I have to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the commissions, I've never really had many commissions. And that hasn't changed. I mean, can you say, well, they've dried up? They haven't dried up. They were never there, really. So now I'm just barking away at the poems, barking away at the plays. And, you know, you're on your own with
the copybook and the bare room and the bare table, and you better get something done, you know.
We should, before we finish, we should talk a little bit about Michael O'Brien, because you've mentioned the plays and you've mentioned the poems. There are also prose stories and novels. And Michael,
only for Michael, there would never have been enough.
Michael O'Brien,
never,
of course,
ever. Michael O'Brien
of O'Brien Press died last week.
A great man. I knew him for over 40 years. And I my deepest sympathy to Svetlana, his beloved partner, to his children, to all involved at the press. He ran a great company. They were so good to me when the book was the books were coming out. And only Michael could have convinced me that I had written a novel. Only he could have done it. Only he had the nerve to tell me I could do it. And not merely did he get the novel out of me, he got the short stories and he got the novella, the woodcutter and his family. I have lost a great mentor. I've lost a great friend, and I'm so distressed that he's gone.
Well, listen, Frank, those are lovely words to hear, and I'm sure his family will be delighted to hear that, and our sympathies to them on their loss, of course, as well. Thanks for coming into us this evening.
Thank you, Sean.
As Frank McGuinness, May the 22nd, his new collection of poems is published by Gallery Press. Dinner with Groucho will be at the Civic Theatre during the Dublin Theatre Festival, 22nd of September through until the 1st of October. Further details on dublintheatrefestival.ie. Cracker Ireland, the title of that track from Gorillaz, and that featuring Thundercat, bringing us to 7:30 on Monday night's Arena for the creative minds of Array Collective. Art and activism are the same thing. The 11-person Belfast-based group of artists won the 2021 Turner Prize for their work, including their Shibeen or Druhub's Ball, which they installed into the Herbert Gallery in Coventry, presenting, or perhaps introducing, depending on your perspective, the nuances of Northern Irish life and politics to the British art world. The work addresses the big issues, marriage equality, abortion, language rights, to name but a few, and has been acquired by the Ulster Museum, will now go on display in Galway at Nuns Island and the Galway Arts Centre for this coming Saturday, right through until the start of October. Joining me from Galway to tell me more about the work itself, the programme of curated events in Galway to accompany their work, and the impact of the Turner on the Array Collective are two of its artists, Laura O'Connor and Stephen Miller. And let's start with, if we could, Laura, I'll start with you, and Druhub's Ball. What exactly it's all about, for those who don't know what a Druhub's Ball is and what happens at it.
How you doing? So the Druhub's Ball for us came about because we use a lot of folklore and pre-Christian stories in our work to kind of talk about current events and take kind of the green and orange out of that. So the Druhub's Ball was a celebration for our Belfast community. When we got nominated for the Turner Prize, we didn't know if people would be able to go to see the exhibition with COVID. So we really wanted to put on an event in Belfast for our wider community who were part of everything that we do. So we created a ball where we invited kind of community activists, allies, colleagues, friends of ours to come along and dress up. And we used the anniversary or the centenary of the partition of Ireland to, as maybe kind of a backdrop, we used the idea of a wake as well to kind of bring all these things together. We invited people to perform. So it was just a night of kind of what we said, buffoonery and chaos, but organised chaos. So we had storytelling, we had wrens, we had keening, we had drag queens. We, you know, lots of different kind of highs and lows. And so that was recorded and turned into a film, and the film went on display in the exhibition in Coventry. So that was a way for us to bring our community to the show, just in case as well that they couldn't get there.
And Stephen, in terms of if Laura mentioning there this idea of trying to take the green and the orange out of what you were doing, and when you take the partition of Ireland and marking that particular event, you're already at a point where you have a very divisive issue. How difficult was it, or is it, to take the green and the orange out of anything from Northern Ireland?
That's a good question. Like, I think for us, it's not that difficult. Like, we were all coming from different backgrounds. Like, not every one of our collective is from the north, even the artists from the south, artists from England, artists from Italy. Like, we're coming at it with, like, equality very much in mind. Like, human rights is the focus. And that affects everyone in the north as it does the rest of Ireland. So when we're trying to tell our stories about our communities, about the people we work with, like it Green Orange like is always in the background, but it doesn't come into it when we're talking human rights. It doesn't and it can't.
Talk to me then a little bit about how the event or the installation, the show itself actually works, because there's quite a diverse amount of material there that, as Laura, as you describe it to us, I'm thinking of an audience in Coventry. Had they any idea what was going on in terms of all of these pre-Christian traditions from this island?
I'm not even sure. I have any idea what's going on when I look at it. But like there are something like over 180 artifacts in the Shebeen itself. Like, so when you go in, you actually enter the space through like a quiet kind of like mythical kind of space. Like it's set up to be kind of like pre-Christian, like kind of like almost like stone circle. But then you go into like a packed Shebeen, like a packed public. Every item, every one of those 180 items have like significance to the rights issues that you talked about. Like I don't know, Laura, like what do you think?
I suppose the Shebeen works as a great container to put all of, you know, kind of artifacts that belong to us and tell stories, and you can understand things on a different level. I think the Shebeen as well is quite a comfortable space, a space that a lot of people know. And we chose the kind of pub because it was somewhere that we would have gone to commune after protests and rallies. The roof of the Shebeen is made out of all the banners that we've used over the years. We made a canopy draped over the top. So there's layers and levels to it. So you can sit and watch the film, and that's, you know, fairly readable, or you can go a little bit closer and start reading things and looking at the, you know, there's etchings and there's a Sheilíní Giggs stone carving. There's lots of pictures on the wall. There's stickers. Like, you know, you can really kind of delve into it and spend time there. And I think it's just, it's not, it's just a comfortable space to kind of read into what you want.
Tell me a little bit then, if you would, whichever you is best versed to do so, about Dark Horse on the Wind, or is it Maeve Mair? Is this part of the Shebeen?
Yeah, so Maeve Mair is a friend of mine. Like, I actually met Maeve Mair. We're both art therapists, and that's how I first met Maeve. But she's like a stunning singer. And she's part of a band called Landless, and if you have not heard of Landless, just check their work out. They're so beautiful. But Maeve's a stunning singer, and like, to kind of go along with the kind of buffoonery and the highs and the silliness and lightness that we try to bring when we're talking about such heavy, really heavy issues in terms of like access to abortion and marriage equality and things that can be so heavy, we've approached them with a lightness, but Maeve approached it with like we gave over when we invited performers to take part in the filming, like to interpret things their way. And Maeve wanted to interpret Ireland's like continued struggle for freedom and the kind of like holding that up like as an ode to it, but also like a lament. That's why she chose that song by Liam Weldon. And she does it just so beautifully. It's so haunting. And one of my favorite parts of like going after Turner Prize show opened was going back as a visitor and watching people's responses to that. Because like, as Laura was saying, people are kind of interacting with the objects, looking around the space, looking at the ceiling, looking everywhere. There's so much to gain. When Maeve sings, people stop in their tracks like during the song. And one of my favorite moments is watching two visitors kind of, because she starts the song by kind of keening the kind of funeral wheel. Some people were kind of giggling at that, which is an okay reaction. But those same people 4 minutes later were in tears, and I was absolutely delighted for them.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Maeve Mair and Dark Horse on the Wind.
Oh, those who die for liberty. Rise,
That's a little flavour there of Maeve Mayer and her song Dark Horse on the Wind, which is part of Belfast Array Art Collective and their current show, their Shebeen show at the Galway Arts Centre in Nuns Island between now and the end of October, as well as a whole series of curated events. And with me this evening from the Array Arts Collective are Stephen Miller and Laura O'Connor. And Laura, Stephen talking there about how people started maybe by giggling, but then that the sheer emotion of that piece, it overtook them. What difference has the winning of the Turner Prize made for you guys, just in terms of the type of exposure? I guess, would you even have been bringing a show like this to Galway had it not been for that Turner Prize win?
Well, we're much busier now. we've all got four jobs rather than two. But would we be bringing a show like this to Galway? I suppose for us, the work was never intended before we got invited to make gallery shows to be in a gallery. We were always very much a kind of on the streets, making banners and making placards and making costumes and, you know, coming up with things like that. It was never kind of a formal practice until 2019 when we showed our first exhibition in London at the Gerwood Arts. So it's an interesting one. I think... yeah, there's definitely like a possibility that we would be showing work in Galway because our practice had been formalised in that way. The Turner Prize has obviously given us a lot of exposure and we're really happy to use that. And we're really happy to use that in Galway to kind of bring people in, bring local people in, local organisations to talk about, you know, issues that are affecting them and the communities here in the west of Ireland and the broader south. So I think for us, it's been really important in a way to use that exposure for the good of the communities that are here and working towards human rights in there.
And what then, Stephen, would you say is the balance between the activism side of what the Array Collective does and the art side of what the Array Collective does?
Yeah, I think that's always like a question. It's always emerging, and like we're maybe figuring out ourselves, because like as Laura says, like it was born out of the streets. Like it was not something like we're all 11 artists in our own with our own practice and our own backgrounds, but we came together for common causes. And as Laura said, like we were invited to take part in the gallery experience. So it's like it's what happens when you merge 11 artists and 11 ideas together. Like it, I guess it works, but I'm not always sure that we can explain how it works.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm sure you are aware of some of the criticisms at the time around this idea that, if, in fact, for the 2021, all of the shortlisted people are work people and artists involved were collectives, and there was a lot of criticism around the idea. Yes, these are great, worthy causes and worthy things to be for there to be activism in and around. But are they art? Is that an important question for you?
No, not at all. I think like some of that criticism at the time was written by people who largely, like it was really clear that they hadn't gone to see the exhibition. There's something about it, like in the British press, kind of really lent towards kind of Thatcher's idea of Britain, like just wanting to hold up the individual rather than groups or communities, like something like about fear, about not wanting people to organise and better themselves. I laughed at a lot of it, but I just like disregarded most of it.
They also said that there wasn't one painter or photographer in the Turner Prize, and Stephen in front of me here is a painter.
I'm
so
a painter.
And I take the odd picture. So they obviously had done no homework before going straight to the controversial headlines, which mean nothing.
I guess Ciara Hickey and Jim Morrow's piece in is it The Elephant?
Yeah, Elephant magazine.
Yeah, is the perfect rebuttal to that criticism. And if anyone wants to read it,
essence did they say? That I suppose you were upsetting the establishment, which I'm sure pleased you. But what was the rebuttal that you agree with, Stephen?
I think like they just like piece by piece went through and showed like with links to the articles that were written, but they piece by piece like showed that the care and everything that's there was there for them to see if they'd bothered to look.
Yeah, it's very clear that they had not looked at the work at all. It's very easy to make those remarks when you're not interested, or it's easier to make a jibe. So, no, we were delighted. We were annoying the right people.
And I noticed that you do refer to yourself as 11 artists. I heard that in several things I looked at and read and listened to today. It is 11 artists at the heart of the collective. We'll finish up maybe by listening to Seamus O'Rourke. And I'm wondering how this went down in Coventry in particular. you might explain what this piece is as we finish up then, Laura.
Yeah, well, I myself am a border woman. I'm from Cavan. So I'm only over the road from Seamus. So I'd heard this when he recorded it first a couple of years ago on RT, I think it was. It's just funny for me because all the stories in it are very relatable. Could cross the border to buy fireworks back in the day. So we talk about something like Maeve's work that you listen to, something like Seamus is just that, you know, it's talking about similar issues but in a completely different tone. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to get at, that there can be humour in seriousness and you can still get your point across. So Seamus's, there was an excerpt of The Hard Border used in the film, which was played over actually the Wren's Claire-Mary Fiersta, who played at the Druids' Ball. But we will be using a full version of The Hard Border relayed over some archive of border checks in Galway Arts Centre, because we'll be showing archive video and other elements of our work in the Arts Centre as well. So it's not just Nuns Island. If you want to know a bit more about the work, you can go to the Arts Centre. A lot of our banners are there, some films, archive material. And also the artists in residence at Galway Arts Centre are Rewind Fast Forward Record at the minute, and they've brought the Irish Names quilt to Galway Arts Centre, so that'll also be on display beside some of our
lots of, again, it's almost like creating a whole new collective in some ways is what you're talking about there.
Listen,
we'll finish up we'll finish up with Seamus O'Rourke and Hard Border, and thanks to both you, Laura O'Connor and Stephen Miller, for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
The border between Northern Ireland and the Republic was great for going across and getting good value. The thought of coming home with unsmuggled goods makes me so sad. You can call Amazon and IKEA, but they have no idea how good it feels to get cheap toilet rolls from Northern Ireland, or wine, or Balin twine, or Christmas decorations. You could fill the Mazda with stuff from Asda for a fiver, and now it's no cheaper. So we must dig deeper if we're going to continue smuggling. We in Leitrim enjoy a good, tough embargo, because then we don't have far to go to break the law. We grew up smuggling sugar and butter and heating oil. Well, you have to be cheating somebody. There's no comedy in shopping at Tesco.
Seamus O'Rourke and his Hard Border, and you can hear a full version or a fuller version of that as part of the Array Collective's work in Galway. The Druids' Ball will be at Nuns Island. Further away, Ray work, as we heard there, at the Galway Arts Centre from this Saturday through until the 1st of October. Full information on this and the series of public events around Array's time in Galway can be found on the website galwayartscentre.ie. Keeper Lit is a new folk and traditional music festival that will take place in the village of Inishteague in County Kilkenny on August the 13th and 14th of this year. The festival will bring afternoon and late night trad sessions to the village, alongside featured performances from the likes of Lisa O'Neill, Claire Sands, Frankie Lane, and a co-headline gig with two of the most acclaimed new folk singers of recent years, Niamh Regan and Bridget May Power. Delighted that Niamh Regan is with me in studio along with her guitar. She had much praise for her debut in 2020 called Hemet. She's going to sing a song from that for us right now, a song called Freeze Frame.
And I was out walking when I heard your voice talking.
Freeze Frame, performed live in studio first by Niamh Regan this evening here on Arena. A game-changing record, a quietly stunning debut, a quiet and determined triumph, one of the best albums released this year, sublime, stunning, a bewitching album, a heartfelt, timeless and captivating release. That's about six of the reviews that were that you got for the album.
About two years ago.
But nevertheless, I'd be reading those all the time if I had reviews like that, I think. But what I'm wondering about it, Niamh, you know, because you got those great reviews, then you couldn't take it out and tour it. How sore was that?
It was a bit bizarre, but, you know, we got there in the end. A year later, in November, we got to go out and tour it. But we're making up for lots of time now, you know, getting to do the festival circuit and really excited to perform this solo, actually, in Kilkenny next weekend.
Oh, yeah, because it was to be a double bit, but unfortunately, Bridget May is not well at the moment. So,
I think she's unwell currently, but I do think she'll be fine.
All right,
then. No, I'll be playing solo myself. It's a headline. We're sharing it.
So all right, so she'll do her bit and you'll do your bit.
Yes, sharing it.
Kind of a big coincidence sober around that, because you're both from Galway. You've never met, I don't think, as far as... And you even share a birthday. You're both born on the 24th of July. No. Belated happy birthday to you.
Thank you. I guess you don't meet your heroes, maybe, you know. I love her music and... it's mad I didn't know she was from Galway, because like she is, I don't know how many albums she's out, but they're amazing, you know. And I'm excited for the gig, you know.
And the last line of that song, I'm sure I'll be fine, 2 years later.
I'm still grand.
I never heard heartbreak sound so gorgeous, I have to say.
Well, thank you. Maybe it's because I'm not that heartbroken.
Yeah,
currently.
and it gave you good material for a song at the time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, it's funny, once the song is written, you kind of move on, don't you?
Yeah.
It's kind of, you give it to listeners and you kind of get what you get out of it when you're writing it.
And and also, I'm guessing that playing Galway Arts Festival, you played at the festival this year, didn't you?
I did,
yeah,
yes.
That must have been a nice thing for you.
Yeah, it was beautiful. You know, like, I grew up going to the Arts Festival in Galway, so to actually, you know, I'm almost, you know, I'm 28 and I met it 28 years later, got invited to be a part of that lineup. So it felt really good to eventually get there. Like a milestone. I don't know why I just told the nation my age.
And lots of people take a lot longer to make it to the Galway Arts Festival. Don't be hard on yourself. Introduce Late Nights for me, which is the opening track from your 2021 EP in the meantime.
Yeah, so in the meantime, the Galway Arts Festival got behind this, actually. They have an Elevate bursary, which basically was some money to support ideas to like get them over the line. And during lockdown, I wrote a batch of songs. So
this is one of them.
This is one of them. So we'll give this a whirl. So thank you, Galway International Arts Festival.
Late Nights from Niamh Regan. I love those little dropped-in spoken bits. It's almost like, you know the way in a traditional song, there are some singers who just speak the last few words. Was that in your mind, or where does the speaking bits come? Where do they come from, Niamh, or do you know?
I wish I knew. I nearly want to say laziness, but like sometimes I just feel like I get the point across better when I speak them. Yeah, every time I sing that song, it's a little bit different. It was originally, like in the studio, there was quite a lot of trumpets and bass line and full band sound. So it's always interesting playing it solo. But yeah, I enjoy.
And do the spoken words vary then? From
absolutely. Yeah.
Depends on how you're feeling.
Yeah, exactly.
If they're not listening, I'll say the word now. Listen, thanks a million for coming in. It's so great to have live music back in studio again. It's been a while since we've had that. That's Niamh Regan. And Niamh will be performing along with Bridget May Power, a co-headline gig at the Keeper Lit Festival this weekend, Saturday the 13th and 14th. You can, all sorts of things happening there. Keeperlitfestival.ie. Niamh has a whole bundle of other events as well. The Seamus Ennis Arts Centre on Friday, Triskell Arts Centre on Saturday. All that before you head to Kilkenny.
So
you're going to be busy. And lots more. NiamhRegan.com will give you details of her gigs subsequently as well. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.